listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Your Ultimate Life, the show completely dedicated to helping you create a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy by using the gifts you have, the skills you have, and your life experience. I'm excited today to have a special guest today with you, Brooks Elms. It's a Hollywood screenwriter. Brooks, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I'm going to start in a really weird place, and that is this. I want you to And this is a question that's really important to me, and it's important for me to talk about, too. Can you tell me, in your own opinion, how Brooks is adding good to the world?
Ooh. I add good to the world through my enthusiasm for telling stories, for my devotion to my audience to help them vicariously live through the heroes of the stories that I tell so that the audience goes for this transformation process from a vice to a virtue experience. And then I'm also, in addition to being a screenwriter myself, I help other writers connect with their audiences. So that goodness comes from, to summarize, all things doing with storytelling at scale.
I love that. And I know that the listeners don't know this, but there's nothing scripted about any of this. And it's not an attempt to catch anybody off guard, but adding good to the world is a choice. What brought you to where, like, often we're only concerned about, you know, our meals and our status and our money and everything else. Adding good to the world is a conscious choice that we do that is a result of something besides that. What brought you to this thing, like, that makes you want to help people, add good to the world, make people's lives better, create better stories, more powerful connection? Tell me about how you got there.
It started for me when I was maybe a teenager. There were times when I was making movies or involved in school plays where I was very deeply sort of connected to what I was doing and very enthralled and excited and sort of tuned in. And I made a lot of movies with my friends in high school. They were often very silly comedies, but we had so much fun making them. And we would show them to people, and people would laugh. And it was like, wow, that energy came from me and my friends creating this thing and then showing it, and the reaction that people were having when they would see it was really very special for me, and it spoke to me very deeply. I mean, I wasn't that aware and able to speak to the depths of it at that point, but I knew it felt really good back then. So I got to a point where I was like, well, what am I going to do with my life? And I was like, oh, well, nothing really feels as good as that, as making movies and sharing with people. So I went to study at NYU Film School, and I learned a lot of things there. Two of the most significant, perhaps, was film literacy, because everybody at NYU Film School are film geeks, and they could reel off the filmography of this director and that director, and I had made a lot of movies, but not watched that many. So that was really exciting. And then from that, getting a sense of film literacy, the other main thing I think I picked up from NYU was a sense of doing something from a personal place. And so I started creating work that was more personal to me. And then that gets to your question about the goodness. I just loved it. I loved creating the stuff myself. I loved being around other people that were creating, and I loved helping them create it. And when something comes together, when there's a movie or a show that really works beautifully, it is goodness. And it's goodness because it's giving people clarity about a particular theme, really. It's a life lesson that's just wrapped into this narrative. And when it's done really beautifully with a team of creators, that energy comes through them and into the people. And then the people watching it get so excited that, like, I've got two movies from posters that are behind me that I love so much. I had nothing to do with personally, but I just love them so much. I saw them many years ago, and I think about them, and I still get excited, that energy. So that to me is goodness that's infinite and really wonderful. That makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So why is it, and people know this sort of intuitively, but why is it that storytelling, like the context of the arc and the character development, why is it that storytelling is so pervasive, so powerful in our world, in our own lives, in our developmental journeys and all that? Talk about that a little bit.
Because it works. And what happens is we could have any sort of thoughts, and we do have all sorts of thoughts about anything. Some thoughts that are very simple, some thoughts that are complex. But narrative is a thought pattern that stacks up thoughts and theories in a bundle. And that bundle experience is amazing when it's crafted with such beauty. So, for example, 100 years ago, the film industry began, right? So photography started before that. But once moving images, the technology came about, totally new industry, we could have done anything. We could have just had, landscape moving images. We could have done anything. But what happened was narrative came roaring through and basically took over the medium in a sense. Now, there's still other ways of doing things with moving pictures. But why? Why did narrative take hold? And it's because it's effing awesome. It's just a great way to think about life, to make sense of our experience of being alive. Narrative coalesces, I don't know if that's the right word, but brings together patterns of thought. So, for example, we get up in the morning and we say, hey, I'm hungry, right? We are the hero. The hunger is an experience. And we go, well, there's going to be a goal. I'm going to go get some coffee and some breakfast. And then the conflict is, I'm out of that food or something. That basic pattern, desire, goal, conflict, is a gravitational center of just how we experience life. So narrative is basically beautiful derivations of that same pattern in all sorts of different genres and all sorts of fanciful ways. But at the core, it's just, we have this experience of being alive, of craving satisfaction. Narrative is a way of sort of spinning that pattern into a story so that you can, and wrapping it around an idea about cowardice to bravery or any vice to virtue, really, if it's a narrative transformation story.
I love that. And it makes me wonder, like, I know you work with writers, and you and I had a conversation the other day about writing, because I've written a lot of books. I'm sure this happens all the time. Someone comes to you and talks about a story and whatever, and then they go down the road of, I don't really have a story, or I can't really do it, or I'm not sure I have much to offer. And they either don't see, or they heavily discount a narrative, which you can see is completely differently. I have two questions in that. One, what makes us so concerned often that whatever it is we have to share that could be a narrative isn't worth much? And then two, what do you do to help someone begin to understand what they could do, what's available?
So the first question, I think, is a variation of a very basic psychological theory that all human beings create. I'm not enough. And I think everybody probably. And the reason I think we come up with that sort of core base is that because we start out like we're kind of not enough in a sense. Spiritually, of course, we're all enough always, and we're born that way, and it's fine. But in effect, when we start to make sense of the world at 3, 4, 5, whatever, we start realizing, oh, these other people are a lot bigger than me, and they can do more things, and they know more things, whatever. In comparison, I am not enough. I'm not like them, in a sense. So I think there's a base just very good theory that, yeah, when we're younger, when we're developing, we are in a different place than other people around us that are older and bigger and stronger and whatever. The problem is, not allowing ourselves to update that theory so that as we grow older, then we really are enough. We really then can do other things, and not in a grandiose way, but no better or worse, just like, no, now I can make decisions and take part in the community and do all those things. And so I think a lot of core psychological imbalances come from just the lack of us not really updating that theory in a way that's just straightforward and saying, oh yeah, before I didn't have that power, and now I do. Instead, we put too much on it or too little or blah, blah, or whatever. So that's one piece of it. I think there's a psychological piece of just growing up that gets blocked for all sorts of different reasons. The second part of the question was, if somebody comes to me and they've got some talent and an inkling that they've got an idea or a story or whatever, well, we all, in my belief, have a fascinating perspective on life, because we're born from a different vantage. Every human being's born from a different vantage point. I mean, there's something like, I don't know, 20 billion people that have walked the planet so far, and there will be who knows walking after us, but nobody's had our exact experience. And one way to sort of concretize that when I do work with screenwriters is we talk about, like in this day and age, this is 2023, you have access to maybe 100,000 hours of movies or TV shows at this point, through all the things, and some stuff you'd have to dig for a little bit more. But in terms of the scope of your life, if you're, let's say, 30 or 40 or whatever years old, you could have watched 100,000 hours, let's say, plus or minus. The actual stuff you did watch is, let's say, 5,000 hours or 10,000 hours, whatever. And then of the, let's say, 7,000 hours of content that you've watched, you choose your favorite 10 films and your favorite 10 TV shows. That is so particular to you or me or anybody. And once I hear that from a writer, what their favorites are, when they could have seen nothing or everything or whatever, and these are the ones that spoke to them, I start to get a sense of, as a storyteller, who they are and how they are different than any other human being ever. And so from that place, if they're coming to me and they've got this fire and this calling to tell stories at scale, I walk them through that process and get a sense of where they're coming from, what sets them on fire as a consumer of movies and TV shows. And then what's going on in their personal life, something that's gnawing at them, a psychological imbalance or a frustration or something big that they overcame in their life or whatever. And then I find the nexus between those two, their favorite films and shows, their insights and life lessons about what they've faced and overcome in their life. And there is an overlapping nexus in those two explorations. And that nexus is a singular movie that nobody else can write in that same way than this person. And then I show them, because I'm a professional writer, how to craft it step by step. So what happens is the people that go through my program is this really beautiful thing where people will read their script and go, oh my God, that's so you. Like nobody else can do it. And if they're interested in something very obscure and artsy, they can do that. But most of the people that come to my program want to do something with bigger audiences. So if it's a big horror movie or a comedy or whatever, it's still singular in a way to this one particular writer because of this process that we use to really get a sense of how we're different and similar than other people.
You know, someone that has developed a spectacular skill and refined it like you have, always goes through ups and downs. You know, Pressfield calls it the resistance or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. As you went to film school and decided you were going to be a writer, for example, instead of 27 other things you could have done or with that. What made you move into the writing piece as your, maybe it isn't your favorite, but I think it's your most productive favorite, the thing that really captures your imagination. Why that?
Well, I started making movies with my friends. So it was like the first one that really felt like a real movie was my friends were already had the idea. They wanted to make this karate movie, where we dressed up in these goofy costumes, and they're like, "Hey, do you want to be part of this?" I was like, "Oh my God, yeah, that sounds amazing." We were 15, and we just made it, and it was a lot of fun. So I didn't identify as a writer. In fact, I came on to that project as an actor, but it didn't matter. It was so collaborative. I mean, I had a sports background, so I was very team centered anyway. And those are guys I played sports with sometimes. So it was best idea wins right from the beginning. And that was part of the fun of it. And as I really, it caught me and I got more and more involved then. And then when I went to NYU, which NYU Film School in the undergrad department that I went to really grooms people to be, you know, writer directors. So I really identified as a writer director very early on, like a, you know, NYU pretentious, serious writer-director, really was that identity. And then I wrote, directed, and produced a few independent feature films. And they were good for what they were, but I knew there was another level that I could get to. So to iterate and keep finding from, you know, having a good response with some of these films that I wrote, directed, and produced, to really getting it to that next level, I started focusing just on screenwriting and then was able to iterate faster. And then that's ultimately when I realized, oh, here's how I can do something that I really care about and that is expressed in a way that has a bigger audience. And that was because the stuff I did at a film school was very personal, autobiographical type filmmaking. And at a certain point, when I really wanted a broader audience, I realized if I took some of that and then leaned into some genre expectations, I could do both. And once I did that, then I got the attention from Hollywood. So, and then from there, I've always been friends with writers and filmmakers and whatever. And I just, I was teaching a class at UCLA Extension and that was fine, but I felt like the experience of making movies and sharing them with people and having really deep connections with people. Plus I had this background in personal growth, men's groups and things like that. I said, there's a really much more impactful way that I can help people than just being a teacher of the craft at a school. And UCLA is a great, great place. I was in their extension department and would teach this class and it was fun. I knew there was more for me. And I realized, oh, if I become like a life coach for screenwriters, in addition to the screenwriting I'm doing myself, that like angels sang, that's a great idea. And then I just was able to, that goodness that we talked about before, it's just goodness all day long. It's because I love it so much. It just, it taps into every facet of what I've been fascinated with for decades. Helping people get the best out of what they want in their life, articulating that in a way that's concretized in a story and that story going out into the world and spreading the goodness that way. So it's just, it's a nexus of all my deepest passions in a type of business model that's perfect for me. And it's fluid, so I can write my own stuff as much as I want. I can help other writers as much as I want. So it's been a really beautiful experience for me. And you spoke to a little bit of like challenges along the way. In theory, I could have probably been doing something like this many years ago, but it took me, you know, the particular road to learn this discovery and that discovery. Like one big discovery was when I got to Hollywood and started getting their attention. I was like, this is great. All right, I'm just going to like get the wheelbarrow and all the money's going to come in. I'm just going to start making movies and blah, blah, blah. But that's not how Hollywood works. It's it will get hot and then cool for a while and then hot for a while and then cool for a while. There's things we can do in the hot streaks. There's things we can do to, you know, minimize the cold streaks. But if we don't plan for them in a way that's just straightforward, and really build shelters against those upcoming storms, it can be really difficult. So,
I was going to ask you in that process. So there's two things that came up for me then. One is you just brought in the idea of life coaching. We were talking about, you know, screenwriting and doing all that, and someone could, you know, make a living and or do whatever they want screenwriting, and then you decided at some point that to have the angels sing, you had to have a piece of being helpful to others, like that service thing. And, you know, when we talked before, I said, I believe that we're built to love and serve each other. I mean, that's just how we feel best and do best in the world, everybody. So when did you get on the, there's two questions. One is, when did you describe your entry and fabulous growth and so forth in the personal development things. There's professional development where you develop a set of skills you're going to sell in the marketplace, whatever they are. And then there's personal development, you know, which is the sort of exploring who we are and why we're here and that sort of stuff. And I want you to talk about how you got there. And the other piece that's kind of related is, was there ever a time or times when you thought, this isn't going to work, I can't do this, you know, the sort of valleys? So what got you into personal development? Talk about that journey. And then have there been a time or two or five or 10 or whatever when it's like, crap.
Great. Two great questions. First, personal growth for me really started when I was in, I guess, third grade. My family split up. So my parents, my dad, we were all living in Akron, Ohio. My dad was a PR executive for Goodyear. He was head of PR department, and he used to be able to get us rides on the Goodyear blimp. So it was really exciting. Anyway, and then my mom grew up on Long Island. So we would go out to Long Island in the summer times. And then they were having difficulties in their marriage. So they split. And then instead of just going for the summertime, in Long Island, we ended up staying there year round. So, and even before that, my dad traveled a lot and wasn't quite around. I wasn't able to connect with him in the way that I wanted. So I had this abandonment thing, and I created this whole abandonment story and this less than and victim thing. So that was sort of fueling some of my thoughts and feelings. And I didn't know how to deal with it then. So I mostly stuffed it and put on a happy face. And so it was, I was a very good boy. And then my dad died when I was 17. So another, you know, the nerve of this guy to do this to me.
And then die on top of it, right?
So a whole other level of abandonment. And I was, in my high school, there was 500 students. And I knew, I think, maybe one, maybe two other people who had lost a parent at that age. It was very unusual. And I didn't know how to deal with it. My mom did the best she could to support me. And, you know, I was hurting really badly. And so so that also fueled some of that personal filmmaking that I did in college at NYU. And I had a therapist right out of, actually during NYU, who was effing amazing. He was this Reichian therapist who was kind of like this outlaw therapist. I don't think he was actually technically licensed, but he was effing phenomenal. My girlfriend at the time, she had a classmate at NYU, and her dad was this guy. And so my girlfriend started seeing him, was like, oh my God, this guy's amazing. You got to see this guy. I said, great, you know, if you can help, because we were having some struggles. So I went to see him, and I'd never been paid attention to like this guy. He just held space, and I just was able to feel my full self, you know, my full power and authenticity by the way this guy would pay attention to me. He was amazing. And so that experience really sort of kicked off. And I was studying some psychology at NYU. I started, you know, some traditional psychology and then personal growth from there. I took a couple of years off from the business in my late 20s. And I went deep diving into personal growth at that point in terms of all sorts of different modalities. When I first came to California in like 2002, I trained to be, I got certified as a massage therapist, which was awesome. So I just was into all sorts of different modalities of personal growth and exploration. Plus I was a lifelong athlete. So I was fascinated with nuances of performance under pressure and measuring that. So that was kind of my mind anyway. So I was like, ooh, taking some of like, how do I get better at sport X? Some of that mindset stuff applied to my existence itself. So I was always curious. And then in my 20s, because I was such a good boy growing up to deal with the, you know, feelings of life. And in my case, it was abandonment. The bad boy side kind of came roaring out in my 20s. And then by my early 30s, I found this men's group called the Mankind Project. And on that initiation weekend, when I was 33, I finally grieved the loss of my father, like fully effing grieved it from my soul. He died at seven when I was 17. I grieved him when I was 33. So it was a long time. But in that process, I was able to really make sense, a lot of really just take much more ownership of my life. So not blaming other people, not being a victim, not being whatever, saying, no, I'm creating my own existence. And it wasn't like everything was perfect there, but it was the main thing I'll say about that about personal growth is part of the problem. And I pushed a lot of people away in my 20s during that bad boy period. And it was partly because I just couldn't, I didn't know how to do it any different. And I just was, and I would, you know, talk to my mom or my sister, and I just would get overwhelmed. I couldn't deal with them. So I just kind of was like, ah, out. And then finally, once I was able to get enough space and then realize, oh, okay. Yeah. If I want support, I got to go to like support people, like support friends, men's group people or whatever, you know, my mom is good for some things. My sister's good for some things, but they're not, you know. And then once I kind of got enough space, I kind of came back and I was like, oh, you know what? I really love my sister for exactly what she's good at. And I don't need her to do things she's not good at. And the same thing for my mom. And my relationship with both of them was beautiful after that point. But I had to come to a point where I had to really just really grow up and get a sense of who they are, who I want to be in relationship with them, and who I don't want to be. And so it was kind of stormy. But it was the only way I could do it. So on the personal side, to summarize, abandonment stuff as a kid, dealing with that by being a good boy early on in my life, in my 20s, being a bad boy, but wholeheartedly embracing the personal growth journey, really from my 20s onward to still now, to make sense of it. And then all of that informed the screenplays that I was writing. I could write characters with much more depth and nuance. And lack of judgment, because in personal growth, the more sort of straight we can see things, not romanticizing and not downplaying it, but just it is what it is, enabled me to write characters that would crackle with authenticity. So my screenplays got better, and I also my life got more peaceful in general and settled in general. The drama was more on the page and not so much in my life in general, of course. And then once I had some of those insights, it was like fun to turn around and go, oh, you know what? I can help other people, because there's just, you know, there's a lot. You can even hear it in the way people speak. And if you're interested in dialogue or interested in personal growth, and certainly you know this, just the way we speak is kind of a window to the way our mind works. And so when I work with writers, I can hear so much in the way they're describing. Is Hollywood a bunch of a-holes that don't like their type, or is Hollywood whatever? It's like the way they frame Hollywood, there's all sorts of opportunities for me to say, hey, I'm hearing you frame it like this. Maybe that's true. But if you actually frame it like that, that might be actually a little more reasonable. And I can do that in a million different ways and a million different subjects through craft, career, and mindset. And those things allow you to become more of the mass scale storyteller that you want to be, because it's always us stopping ourselves. And the way we stop ourselves is these ideas of grandiosity or selling ourselves short or selling ourselves too high in a way. And so what I do is I just help people see things with more like inspired authenticity and actuality. Which is what we need to do as great screenwriters anyway. We need to say, look, this is really what the hero is and what the real goal is and the real conflict is. And when we can articulate that with specificity, it crackles with that authenticity and it blows people the F away. And dialing that in is a really exquisite process of just getting to know ourselves in really nuanced, specific ways. So the experience of realizing your vision in a screenplay is the best personal growth thing ever. So, and as a guy who loves personal growth and loves screenwriting, that's part of that whole Nexus experience for me. It all really comes together.
So one of the things that you said repeatedly during that, in both subtle and direct ways, is the ownership piece. Mm-hmm. You described it in the relationship with your sister and your mom. You expected a certain thing, and the thing that changed wasn't them, it was you.
That's right.
And then in the context of understanding life and how you talked about those writers, their view of Hollywood didn't change. They made a choice at your suggestion to frame whatever they want. So, and there were several others during that conversation that you had. It seems like over and over again, and I agree with this, by the way, the foundational piece that, number one, allows you to live at peace with yourself, and number two, create something that matters. And in your case, it's a story that is, or more, many stories that crackle with authenticity, as you talked about, is your ability to and willingness to see things as they are and to take ownership of how you create your life. I want you to talk a little bit more about that creating life piece, because to me, that's everything. Who you decide to be every minute of every day, in fact, every moment, that's all there is. And all the rest is decoration. So I want you to tell me a little bit more about creating yourself, creating life.
Great. Let me do it in two different ways. One from the sort of the screenwriting perspective, and then we'll talk about kind of the personal growth perspective. From the screenwriting perspective, there's a wonderful story about one of my favorite films, Raging Bull. Martin Scorsese directed it. Robert De Niro acted in it as his fighter. Jake LaMotta was a real life fighter, and came out in 1980. And when Scorsese and De Niro, I heard this story. I certainly wasn't there in 1980. I was, I don't know, 12 or something. Anyway, I was nine. I hear that they were, they went to the studio and they talked to an studio exec, and they were like, hey, you know, we want to make this movie about this character. This is a rough character. This is a character who was not, Jake LaMotta was not the best father, not the best brother, not the best husband. But an amazing fighter. In fact, what makes the story amazing is, as great as he was as this fighter with power and tenacity and endurance, in some ways made him like a terrible at relationships, right? And that's what attracted, I think, Marty and De Niro to this material. The studio exec was like, "What? Why do you guys want to make a movie about this guy? He's like a cockroach." And De Niro reportedly said, "No, he's not." And that's it. Just that simple. No, he's not. De Niro, as the artist that he is, was seeing him straight. He's a human effing being. And that commitment to somebody, in fact, somebody who's in many ways extremely flawed. And when we can embrace the flaws in the way they did with that movie, you get something that's an absolute astonishing masterpiece. Because it's all those things. He's this amazing fighter and he's a terrible person, and gets to the end of a life where he can kind of at least be at peace with himself through the storms of his existence. Okay, so that's from an artist or writer's perspective in terms of judgment of what is, and ideally lack of judgment, just seeing it straight. From a personal growth perspective, I would invite anybody listening to this to use that same lens that I just spoke about in terms of how De Niro saw that character straight. So straight. To use that same lens on your own deepest passions or passion. And there's a range. There's people who already are aware of their passion there's something about the way that they're seeing their passion that they're not using it to be of service to themselves and the community, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for this, in my view, that our educational system hasn't evolved to the point where we're really supporting students in lifestyle design and perception design. That's really what humans need at this point, right? We're still teaching reading, writing, and math, which is, you know, really 100 years, if not older, way of, you know, better than life on the farm, better than life in a factory. But as Bob Dylan said, 20 years of schooling, and then they put you on the day shift. It's really kind of a more of a factory type lifestyle design that they force students to do. So the reason I bring it up is because it totally Fs people. It divorces them from their real calling, from their life purpose. Like, how many people do you know that graduate high school at age 18 and then have this beautiful free lifestyle design? Like, zero. Well, why?
Yeah, that would be zero.
Yeah.
Because nobody ever brought it in. The only thing they've ever been exposed to is grades, judgment, categorization, put downs, you know, and all, and getting in trouble, trying not to be in trouble.
That's exactly right. So they've had no practice in what's really important, which is how do I make sense of the world for me subjectively? What's my deepest gifts, and where in the community are people needing these gifts? Right. That's what it's all about. And that is learnable for 15-year-olds and not being taught, unfortunately. So what do we do about it? You got to figure your shit out. And a lot of artists are really effed because the arts gets often very squashed. So they have this passion. They know they love painting or poetry or sculptor or whatever. And they have no real training in how to sort of do that in a way that's in legitimate service to the community. So the point being is, like, you got to be honest about what you care most about. That is the thing that, like, if you're not going to do what you care most about, then, like, what's the alternative? Because the alternative is what you kind of learn in school is, well, they told me I got to jump through the hoop and get the grade, but that's all bullshit. I don't know if I can curse here. Sorry. But, like, it's BS because what we really need to do is whatever we're here, whatever our calling is, and then whatever the community wants. And that's that nexus again that I told you about. And so since we're not being really experienced and trained and taught that in school, we have to figure it out on our own. And some people never figure it out. In fact, most people, I did a Twitter poll months ago, and I said, how many people are living like their dream life? You know, really happy. And it was probably 10%. You know,
really that high? I'm surprised that it's that high.
Well, that's what they said in the poll. But it's interesting because, like, in theory, anybody can do it, but in practice, because we've been trained to have a lifestyle design set for us for those first, you know, almost 20 years if you go to college too. So the point is, what do we do about it? Wherever you are on your road is perfect. You just say, okay, here I am, whether I'm 65 or 16 or anything in between, I'm right here, right now. Here's what I care most about. If I'm at some 9-to-5 job that I don't like, how do I make it a little more tolerable, a little better? You know what I mean? It's like wherever you are, take one little step forward. And eventually try to get to a point where you are in the calling of your existence all day long in a way that's most in service to other people, because that's the most joy you're going to have in your life, and the most goodness you'll be creating as a byproduct of being aligned with your deepest life purpose and of biggest service to the community. Like, one of the things I like about you is you have these really big goals to impact so many people. And I think that's really beautiful. And I think that the reason that's so unusually awesome is because people aren't thinking about that part of it, how satisfying it is to serve so many people. It really is. It's more satisfying to do what we love to, like, if you have the choice of doing exactly what you love to do and you're on a mountain by yourself, that's fine. But I promise you, if you're doing what you love to do and you're doing it in the community and you're passing that energy on, it's infinitely even more satisfying. So it's not one or the other. You really can do both. And you certainly don't want to be in the community but miserable, right? You want to have find that win-win existence.
Well, that's where we start because of the framework, the way it is. We're in the community and we sell skills. We sell our skills as a lawyer, dentist, pizza delivery person, or whatever. And it's got nothing to do with what we love and the gifts that we have. It's just a set of skills that we learned because that's what was drummed into us. And we sell those skills in the community to make money and to pay. But we have this yearning inside, and so there's this eternal mismatch. 70-something, 80% of people don't like their jobs because there's not that nexus that you talked about, where you then realize, and this is the thing, so many people that I hear, they say, well, yeah, I'd love to do what I love to do, but I can't make a living. Nonsense. If you do what you love to do and combine it with skills that you learn, you're going to have something more valuable. More valuable than just some crap you learn to do, some skill. I don't care what it is. If you add to it, the natural gifts and the yearning and all the rest. So I love that, and it's true, and I'm all excited because I wholeheartedly support life design. You can make the most impact, you can have the most fun, and you can make the most money. Now, I want to make sure you tell people all about how to find out more about you. Like, we've talked before two or three times, but I don't really know if or where you're active on social, websites. Where can they check out some of your brilliant writing work that you've done? Like, tell people now where they can go find out more about Brooks.
Well, if you're adventurous, you can just Google me, Brooks Elms, B-R-O-O-K-S-E-L-M-S, or search me on YouTube. You'll see all sorts of resources there. Or specifically, the best place is probably my Twitter account, which is now being renamed X. So either twitter.com Brooks Elms or x.com is probably coming, Brooks Elms. But yeah, just search me. I'm not hard to find. And then you'll start, what you'll find is the experience will be, you'll see a video of me. It'll kind of like this. You're like, this guy's kind of strange, but he's kind of making some sense or whatever. Or not. Maybe it's just, you know, I'm the strange guy and that's how I'm serving you, as somebody that gets you to the next thing, and that's fine. Other people will go, no, I really, there's something to this guy. And I do have a screenplay that I want to write, or I've been trying to write screenplays and I'm stuck or whatever. And just keep following the breadcrumbs, get closer and closer to me. And then, if synchronicity is smiling upon us, maybe we'll get into a conversation and I will help you move forward. Here's an interesting thing about, talking about what we're talking about. So in that period of my life when I was really in some despair and saying, F the world, and I needed to really figure things out, the bad boy.
Was that the bad boy 20s? Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, I asked you for the ups and downs, and it sounds like 25 was a pit.
It was later 20s for me. It was
later 20s. It was great. Okay.
I told the whole world to F off. But I had this wonderful massage therapist at the time, and we had this great conversation, and he told me this story about this. It was an Indian mythology story or whatever, but it was about this guy who basically got to a point in his life where he just was taking people across a river, just taking from one side of the river to the other, one side of the river to the other. And for some reason at that point, it effing terrified me. Like, there's something psychologically that scared me. But what I realize now in my life, and yeah, I'm in this sort of, you know, exciting business and blah, 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 but really at the core of what I do, whether I'm telling a story to lots of people myself or helping other people tell their stories, it really feels like I'm just finding somebody, helping them get into the canoe, taking them across a river, or however they want to cross. Some people swing across the vine, some people swim across the river. I have all sorts of ways to get them across, and I love it. So whether it's the audience or somebody else doing crossing river to find their audience. So anyways, so that's that. Just search me, Brooks Elms. I'll pop up. Follow away, you know, you can get, I have a website, but you know, Twitter or X is really a good place to kind of see more of my content. And then if you feel like I could help you across a river, reach out to me. We'll have a conversation and who knows, maybe I can help you.
So I want you to think about, like, you're a coach. I'm a coach. Our business, I think of coaching as being in the people encouragement business, all the way. From, I have all kinds of funny names: the obstacle obliteration business, blind spot protection service. You know, a bunch of those kind of funny names, right?
I like them.
Yeah, I have a dozen or 13 of them that I keep adding to when I think of a new one. But anyway, you have spent a lot of time and effort, and I was in a conversation earlier today with a doctor who's my doctor because my lungs and that stuff that happened to me 5 years ago when I died and all that stuff. So I see a doctor regularly about lung stuff. And he was talking about personal development. He said, oh, but that personal development stuff is hard. And I and he knows that I'm a coach. And I was talking about one of my other clients who's also a doctor. He turned and I turned and looked at him. I said, no, it's not. And he said, well, let me restate that. I mean, it requires dedication. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll buy that. You know, and he was a little bit, you know, upside the head because I said, no, it's not. But anyway, so we had some conversations.
That's like that Robert De Niro face. He's a cockroach. No, he's not.
Yeah, I flat out, I said, no, it's not. And so, but it got into some further conversation. But anyway, because you've spent this time, I'm going to slow down here for a minute and urge the audience to listen to the answers to this question. Because someone who spent the kind of time that Brooks has in learning to reframe the pain of his teen years and his father dying and the divorce or the separation and divorce and the work that it takes to understand, not stuff, but understand and reframe, and then go beyond, turn it to your advantage in understanding and growth. Someone that's taken the time to do that has something to say. So I want to ask you, your ultimate life, this is the text, but I want you to frame that any way you want and share whatever it is about this process of self-worth, self-growth, storytelling internally and externally that we, your audience, right this minute need to hear.
Great. So the takeaway I invite for people that are hearing this is my particular flavor of adversity was an abandonment experience. So as a kid, subconsciously, I was reeling and feeling like, I wish I had a dad to do this. And I wish I had, I played sports, but I loved my coaches, but they weren't really great, great coaches. So I studied the great coaches. So I wish I had this sort of coach. I wish I had this sort of dad. I wish I had this sort of mentor. And because I was a guy that was thinking about that so many different ways, when I finally sorted out and owned my own challenges and stabilized my own life, I realized, oh, all that thinking I did about wanting things to be different in a way was training myself to be the dad that I always wanted to be, the mentor to other people that I always wanted to be, the storyteller to the audience that I always wanted to be. And that only came from me embracing what my particular flavor of adversity is. You have your own. Everybody listening to it, to this thing has their own. And I promise you, whether you're in a place where you're not very aware of it or you are super aware of it, either way, it is your gift. That is the thing that makes you so interesting, because nobody has thought about adversity in your certain flavor, in your certain way, like you have. That makes you world class about insights around your particular type of adversity. So you get to do whatever you want with it, whether it's being a doctor or this or that, or that if you're a storyteller, then you get to tell stories that are inspired life lessons from how you dealt with your adversity. And when you do that, you know, and you do well, Hollywood pays you a lot of money and a lot of good things happen. But the money's all secondary. You do it just for the sheer enjoyment of realizing your vision, saying, I think this is how life is. And then you articulate it in a way with such clarity. And then other people go, holy crap, that's how life is. Thank you for telling my story. And of course, we told our own story. So does that answer the question in the way you were hoping?
I had no expectation. What I heard, Brooks, is, and I want to repeat it because I love it so much, the struggles that we have had, way more than the victories, the struggles, the insults, the pain, the bad breaks, name it whatever you want. That is the building blocks for the richness of the texture and fabric of your life. So I don't care where you are. What I just heard him say is that all of the bad juju, bricks, breaks, is the texture of growth, is your opportunity.
And here's why. Because I'm not the last person that's going to face abandonment. And when I can sort out my thought and be really clear about how I handled abandonment in a way that made things worse and how I learned to make it better, and I can put that in a screenplay or teach other people based on whatever their adversity is, that's when I have, in storytelling terms, talk about the elixir, that I found the elixir and I share the elixir with other people. So that's my insight. My insight is about that particular type of adversity. You have your own. And when you go out and share that in the world, then the next person, the next Kellen, who's suffering right now, who can't get that insight unless you tell your story, you do your thing. You're letting that person down unless you embrace those, that adversity and those insights and life lessons around it, and then put it into your own product or service into the effing marketplace so that they can find it and so you can help those people. They need you, Kellen, and they need me and everybody listening to this. There's people out there that need you and your gifts, and you got to craft your gifts into your thing in whatever your dream craft skills are.
So I love that. Brooks, I want to thank you today for taking time to be part of this show and for sharing that and this summary about taking your difficulties and figuring out how to make them valuable. Get rid of the stories about they're not important and all the rest of the nonsense we have. Understand that they're precious. They're the diamonds of your life, and you have them to shine. So polish them and give them away. Thank you for being part of the show today, Brooks.
Thank you for having me. What an invitation. What a man you are, with the energy that you bring and the clarity that you bring to your life and your commitment to sharing your gifts with people. Real honor for me to be here, brother.
Well, thank you. People in the audience that have listened to this, I want you to take the opportunity to go through this slowly. Take it apart. Understand that gold is in your hands. Love, life, opportunity. It's there for you to mine. It's there for you to enjoy. And it multiplies when you share it. And if you do, you will be surprised, you will be rewarded, and you'll be able to create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.